Lecture 10, Mahayana Buddhism and the Bodhisattva Ideal.
For the last few lectures, we've been working on what you might call traditional Buddhism. Theravada Buddhism in Southeast Asia is admittedly a pretty contemporary movement and in some ways quite different today from Buddhist practice at the time of the Buddha, but it still represents quite deliberately a conservative option, and it looks back to the example of the early community. We saw that in King Mongkut's reform movement that deliberately attempted to reappropriate and reapply the ideal of the traditional Pali canonical scriptures. This was not the only option in the Indian tradition historically. And it's time for us now to look at a reform movement that made a radical change in the way people enacted the Buddhist ideal in traditional India. It changed the style and the tone and the content of Buddhist practice in profound ways, only a few centuries after the lifetime of the Buddha. We call this movement the Mahayana, or the Great Vehicle, a movement that emerged in the Indian Buddhist community around the beginning of the Common Era. Eventually, the Mahayana, the Great Vehicle, spread to China, Tibet, Japan, Korea, and to Vietnam. And of course, there are many varieties of Mahayana Buddhism that are available for us to observe, comment on in our own homeland today. The name Mahayana comes from the literature of the movement itself. It's a name that it applied to itself and used to distinguish itself from what it saw as the Buddhism that came before. Mahayana texts refer to themselves as a great vehicle, in contrast to what they call the Hinayana, or the lesser vehicle that preceded it. The best place for us to look in a scriptural source for an account of the contrast between the Mahayana and the Hinayana is in a text called the Lotus Sutra. It's a text that we'll refer to quite often, actually, in our discussion of Buddhism in China and Japan, because it had an enormous influence on the development and the shape of Mahayana Buddhism as it began to move across the rest of Asia. The key passage in the Lotus Sutra that talks about the Mahayana is a passage that's known as the Parable of the Burning House. I can tell you the story and then I'd like to comment on some of the distinctive features of it so that we can get some sense of the shape, not just of the Mahayana itself, but also how it distinguished itself from the earlier tradition and how it found very distinctive scriptural expression. The story goes something like this. There's a father who lives in a large house with a large number of children. The father is outside, the house catches on fire, and he looks up at the house. The children are all playing in the windows, and they're all ignorant. They're not aware of the fact that the house is on fire, and he wants to get them out. He wants to save the children from the house. You can see already that we've got here a reference to that old Buddhist idea of everything burning. If all is on fire, then the house we live in this world also is on fire. And the Buddha is someone who is trying to get us out of the house and help the fire go out. So the father looks up at the children and says to them, "Okay, kids, come on out of the house. The house is on fire. All is burning." And the kids say, "Well, you know, we're having such a great time in here. There's no reason for us to leave. Why should we come out?" And the father says, "Well, you know, I've got some toys out here for you to play with. I've got some big carts. If you come out of the house, you can play with these great toys, with these carts. For some of you, I've got a deer cart. For some of you, I've got another kind of cart. Whatever you want, I've got for you outside this house." So the children are excited by this, and they come running out of the house and to look for the carts that the father is offering them. And the father says to them, "Well, it's great now that you're outside. It's great that you've saved yourself from the fire in the house, but I want to tell you something. Actually, I don't have those carts for you that I promised. I've got an even greater cart. a vehicle that is decorated in all sorts of extraordinary ways, and you're going to have a fabulous time playing with it. So hop on and take it for a ride. Then the text begins to offer some commentary about the story. It obviously makes the connection that you'd expect it to make. It says that the Buddha is like this father. And the little carts that he first promised to the children who were in the house were those lesser vehicles, the so-called disciple vehicle and the so-called solitary Buddha vehicle, that were preached before the coming of the Mahayana and that were meant to lure the people who were caught in the burning house of samsara out in order to receive the real teaching that the Buddha has to offer them. What's that real teaching? It's the Mahayana. It's this great, beautiful cart that the Buddha finally offers to all the children once they've escaped the house, the burning house of samsara. Now, in the text, as it's elaborated, there are a couple of important concepts that come out, the Buddha develops, that are important for, or the text itself develops, actually, that are important for us to notice. First of all, as the story comes to an end, it says that this vehicle, this cart, this Mahayana that has been presented to the children after they've made it out of the house, is the one great vehicle. It's the real teaching of the Buddha. So all those other teachings that came before are, as it were, preliminary exercises that are meant to get a person started on the path to salvation, but are not meant to constitute the Buddha's final teaching. So one of the most important doctrines in the Lotus Sutra, especially in China and Japan, as the text was used and elaborated in those cultures, is the doctrine of the one vehicle. The Buddha teaches, in the end, one particular way to salvation, as it is embodied and expressed in this text of the Lotus Sutra. Now, another concept that's important here that runs all the way through the Mahayana tradition is the concept of skillful means. The text raises a question as it explores the meaning of this story about whether the Buddha lies to people by presenting these preliminary teachings. Did the father lie to the children by telling them that he has a different variety of cart for each one of them? The answer that the text gives is that it's not really a falsehood to skillfully lure someone along the way to salvation. This skillfulness is called skillful means. It's an important concept in the Mahayana as the practice of the Mahayana was elaborated in later Buddhist literature. It has to do with the ability of creatively, imaginatively, using the categories of this world to move them along the road to salvation so that they can come more and more to understand the true nature of reality and achieve enlightenment as the Buddha intended it to be achieved. Now, you could ask, it seems to me, a pretty good question. It's a natural question to ask when you encounter the Mahayana for the first time. Where does this great tradition come from? Where would such a radical reform movement arise in the community of the early Sangha? Well, one place to go for an answer to this question is to the Mahayana texts themselves. The texts trace the origin of the Mahayana to what's called a second turning of the wheel of the Dharma on the Vulture Peak in Rajagriha during the life of the Buddha himself. In other words, the Mahayana texts claim to be the teaching of the Buddha himself, delivered to a special assembly of bodhisattvas from which other Buddhist practitioners, the followers of those other vehicles, the disciples and the solitary Buddhas, have been excluded. And the Mahayana texts then go on to say that the Mahayana was concealed for several centuries until the world was ready to receive it. And then the sutras, the texts of the Mahayana, were brought forth and promulgated across India. So there's an awareness here in the Mahayana itself that the tradition is new. It's not something that's known in the traditional community. And the way that they can explain the novelty of this tradition is to say, well, the Buddha really did teach it. It's his real teaching, the one that he really intended, but people weren't ready to hear it during the lifetime of the historical Buddha, so it was concealed for several centuries and then brought forth and promulgated in this world. Now, all of this is very nice, but scholars are really quite uncertain, truth be told, about what the actual origin of the Mahayana is. There's suggestions in the Mahayana tradition that practitioners perhaps fasted and meditated in order to receive visions and revelations from great Buddhas of the past. It's conceivable that some of the early texts of the Mahayana came to people in this way, as visions that they interpreted as being revelations from past Buddhas. Although this really can't be true of the most elaborate literary sutras of the Mahayana. Many of the Mahayana sutras don't have the quality really of visionary experiences, but of literary texts, literary documents. Some scholars have suggested that the Mahayana arose among circles of lay people who were worshippers at particular stupas, at shrines where the relics of the Buddha were the focus of devotion. This view has now been pretty much discredited by scholars. It seems clear that the Mahayana had a strong monastic component right from the very beginning. So it's not accurate to say that the Mahayana was a lay movement as opposed to a monastic movement. It included components of both. So if we're uncertain about the origin of the Mahayana, what can we say about the basic teaching of the Mahayana? The answer to that question is a lot more clear. The fundamental teaching of Mahayana Buddhism is what's called the Bodhisattva ideal. A Bodhisattva, as you recall from some of the discussion we had of the lifetime of the Buddha, is a Buddha to be, somebody who isn't a Buddha yet, but somehow plans to become a Buddha in a future life. You can translate the word Bodhisattva as future Buddha, Buddha to be, somebody who is on the path to Buddhahood sometime down the road in a future life. And a Bodhisattva in the Mahayana tradition doesn't attempt to go straight to Nirvana, but returns to this world and attempts to help others along the path to Nirvana. This means that Bodhisattvas can include laymen and laywomen, as well as monks and nuns, because all of us, whether we're monks or not, can be understood to be part of some path that leads us to Buddhahood down the road in the future. Bodhisattvas who come back like this into this world to help others along the way cultivate two important virtues. This is really significant in the Mahayana. Two important virtues. One, of course, is wisdom, that great virtue that was discussed in the early accounts of the Buddhist path that leads you to Nirvana, wisdom that involves the understanding of no self and frees you from attachment to this world. But in addition to wisdom, Bodhisattvas explicitly now, in a way that really wasn't consciously understood before, develop the virtue of compassion. The word is karuna. It's a crucial Mahayana word. So Bodhisattvas do two things, cultivate two virtues. Wisdom, you might call it a contemplative virtue, a quiet virtue that has to do with understanding the nature of the self and the nature of the world. And then compassion, a virtue that has to do with actively seeking the welfare of others. The Mahayana always has this double aspect, contemplation, action, understanding the self and bringing that understanding into the world to make it available for other people. My old teacher of Buddhism at Harvard used to talk about the Bodhisattva path as two-way traffic, a two-way street as opposed to a one-way street. I like to think of it sometimes more as a circle. And when I talk about the Bodhisattva path, one of the things I do very often is simply step to the blackboard and start drawing circles with samsara as the beginning of the circle, nirvana somewhere along the circle, perhaps at the top of the circle, and then the circle connecting to itself, bringing you back into samsara after you've tasted some quality of understanding that might lead you to nirvana. The Bodhisattva is constantly coming back into this world to help others. Now, the Bodhisattva ideal is contrasted to the ideal of earlier Buddhism by distinguishing itself from what's called the Arhant ideal. The Arhant was a person in the earlier community who sought nirvana in this life for him or herself. So an Arhant is someone who follows the one-way traffic to nirvana and doesn't come back into samsara like the Bodhisattva. So the Mahayana teaches a Bodhisattva ideal as opposed to an Arhant ideal. Some people say that a Bodhisattva renounces nirvana in order to lead all other beings to nirvana. If you follow this model, you can sometimes imagine a Bodhisattva as returning back into the world, becoming involved with people, teaching them about compassion, helping them understand reality in a way that's consistent with traditional Buddhist teaching. And then finally, when everyone is ready for nirvana, it's like holding hands and stepping off a cliff together. The Bodhisattva doesn't become a Buddha until everybody is ready to become a Buddha with him or with her. The truth is that this is not strictly accurate because bodhisattvas can become Buddhas. They simply aspire to become a Buddha for the sake of all other beings. And when they can become a Buddha in a way that really, in some way, perfectly serves the needs of other people, then that bodhisattva will become a Buddha. So the Mahayana world is full of Buddhas as well as bodhisattvas, people who have pursued the bodhisattva path and pursued it to perfection. Now, bodhisattvas described in Mahayana literature are often human beings just like ourselves. It's a very human ideal, as the ideal of Buddhist practice was in the earlier tradition. I'd like to give you a couple of examples of Mahayana descriptions of bodhisattvas, so you can get a sense of the kind of person who was described as a bodhisattva in this classical literature. One of the most important, and one of my favorite, I'd have to say, in the early literature of the Mahayana, is a bodhisattva known as Vimalakirti. He was a wise layperson who pretended that he was ill in order to teach a lesson to the Buddha's monastic disciples. Let me read you just a short account of Vimalakirti from the beginning of the Mahayana Sutra that presents his teaching. And in the city there lived an elder named Vimalakirti, who dwelt there as a skillful means for the salvation of other beings. For he used his measureless wealth to convert the poor, and his own pure virtue to convert those who broke the precepts. He controlled himself with patience to convert the scornful, and strove with diligence to convert the lazy. He used his calm meditation to convert the confused, and his firm wisdom to convert the ignorant. He wore the white robes of a layman, but he observed the pure conduct of a recluse. He lived a household life, but he wasn't attached to the world. He had a wife and children, but always practiced the religious life. And he kept a household, but always delighted in solitude. He wore jewels and ornaments, but adorned his body with the signs of greatness. He ate and he drank, but delighted in the taste of meditation. He went to the gambling halls, but he worked for the salvation of men. He took on the ways of the heretics, but never strayed from the true faith. And he knew all the worldly texts, but he always delighted in the teaching of the Buddha. Now, this mean, it's hard, I suppose, when I read a text like this. You know, I'm reading simply from an ancient text that describes a particular ideal in words that might, in many respects, seem remote. It's hard sometimes to see how radical and how important the shift in values is here. In the earlier tradition, we really were talking largely about monks and nuns. The ideal practitioners of the Buddha's path were those monks who and nuns, and I really shouldn't distinguish between the two here, the monks and nuns who had engaged in an act of renunciation and pursued the monastic life in the same way that the Buddha did. Now this tradition is being opened up explicitly to lay people, not as a kind of compromise, but really as a way of saying that lay Buddhist values and the lay Buddhist life is a place where you can actually pursue the fundamental teaching of the Buddha. And as you can become a bodhisattva as the Buddha once was and pursue that great path that's going to lead you eventually to enlightenment. And when you do that, you bring into ordinary lay life all of these important values that are significant in Buddhist practice. Sure, you eat and you drink. You go out and have a couple of beers. You may have a great feast. You may live with your family in a big house. You may even go to the gambling halls. Maybe you go and visit Las Vegas or wherever the gambling center is that's near your community. But you always do it in a way that's going to bring Buddhist values in some fashion into that place to make them available for other people. So this is the bodhisattva engaged in the world in a positive and affirmative way. It's a crucial shift in the basic understanding of Buddhist life. And it had, as you can imagine, radical effect on the spread of Buddhism throughout Asia. Chinese were always very suspicious of monastic life because it seemed to turn its back on the values of the family. But here in the figure of Vimalakirti, you've got somebody who really lives out the Buddhist values within the context of ordinary lay life. So the Buddhist tradition now is shifting. The center of gravity really is moving in a way that takes it out of that strictly monastic ideal that was present in the early tradition. Now, Vimalakirti is a pretty good example of the way this process works. But there are others, too, that are important to mention. They're worth knowing just to see how broadly the Mahayana ideal was extended. There's an important queen by the name of Queen Srimala, who is the focus of another Mahayana text, who is involved in all of the concerns of life of the palace. She's a queen, there's a king, there's a lot of responsibility that she bears within the ordinary life of the palace, and yet she is portrayed in the text as being one of the wisest followers of the Buddha, and is the source of one of the most important Mahayana doctrines. The doctrine itself is, of course, one of the focal points in the text, but even more importantly is the implicit claim that even this queen, Queen Srimala, who seems in many respects to be engaged in a life that's very different from the classic life of a traditional monk or nun, can be a locus of great wisdom and an exemplary practitioner of the Mahayana ideal. Another figure who is worth knowing about, I think, who becomes important in later Chinese and Japanese Buddhism, is a young man by the name of Sudana, who, teenager really, goes out on a long quest in order to achieve some kind of religious insight. He visits 50 different teachers, different gurus. And finally, at the very end, he comes to a bodhisattva by the name of Samantabhadra and is given a vision of the universe vastly more complex and complete than anything we found earlier in this tradition. Let me read you an example of a passage from the text that describes Sudana's concluding vision. Then Sudana, the teenager, the son of the guildmaster, reflecting upon the body of the final bodhisattva in his quest, the bodhisattva Samantabhadra, saw in every pore of that body untold quadrillions of Buddha fields being entirely filled up with Buddhas. And in every single one of those quadrillions of Buddha fields, he saw Buddhas surrounded by countless assemblies of bodhisattvas. And gradually he came to equal that bodhisattva, Samantabhadra, in his quadrillions of vows and practices. He came to equal all the Buddhas, and he came to equal with them the pervasion of all of the universe that he saw projected in the body of Samantabhadra, the bodhisattva. This is a vision of reality vastly greater than anything we've seen in the earlier literature. It has to do with an expansion of the imagination that brought the Mahayana into realms and into practices very different from anything we saw before in the earlier tradition. Now, you could ask yourself, finally, as we encounter the bodhisattva ideal for the first time, how is the bodhisattva ideal expressed in ritual and in philosophy? The most important single concept to express the bodhisattva ideal is the concept of the bodhicitta, a concept that I would translate as the mind of enlightenment, or you might say the mind that seeks enlightenment. To enter the bodhisattva path, it's important to generate, as the texts say, this mind of enlightenment. What is it? Simply the aspiration to seek enlightenment for the sake of all other beings. So a bodhisattva who enters the bodhisattva path starts with some kind of gut feeling. I want to be enlightened in order to bring that enlightenment in some way to others. It has these two components, the component of wisdom, the component of compassion. And this mind of awakening, or mind of enlightenment, is then generated and cultivated as the bodhisattva path proceeds. Now, as you see this evolving in Mahayana literature and Mahayana practice, it becomes quite a complex and subtle concept. You can see at the very beginning that in some respects it's a moral aspiration. I want to help others. I want to develop myself in a way that's going to be helpful to other people. But you can also see that it has what you might call a cognitive component. It involves a perception of yourself as being connected in a relationship of interdependence with all other beings, so that you become aware of yourself in a different way at the same time that you express this moral aspiration. It also has what I would call, I suppose, an ontological component, in the sense that it has to do with an awareness of your own being. In Buddhism, your mind, in the end, is you. Whatever you are is the cultivation and the evolution of your own mind. So if you express this mind of enlightenment, if you feel this aspiration to help others, what you feel is an expression of your own Buddha nature arising from within you. So it has to do with a transformation of your own personality, your own being, as well as a moral aspiration to help others. And then it also is complex, and I think rather subtle, in one further respect. To arouse the mind of enlightenment is a pretty simple thing. You know, we could do that today. In fact, we probably have aspirations that are similar to that very often in the flow of our daily lives. Geez, you know, I'd really like to help others in some way and develop the moral capacity and the insight that would make that effective. It's pretty easy. It's a pretty simple feeling to have. And yet it contains within itself implicitly the full enlightenment of the Buddha. It's the preliminary stirring of your own Buddhahood, arising out of your own simple moral aspiration to help others. So the bodhicitta is an important concept in the Mahayana. It's complex, it's subtle, and it evolves in all sorts of fascinating ways. Finally, I should mention that the Bodhisattva path is divided into a series of formal stages. It's not merely an aspiration, it's something that takes a very particular form, as the path did in the earlier tradition. One way to divide it is into six perfections: the perfection of generosity, the perfection of moral conduct, patience, courage, mental concentration, and wisdom. So a lot of Mahayana texts discuss a passage through six stages to reach the experience of full Buddhahood. There are other accounts that divide the path into 10 stages, but they're not radically different than the path that I've just outlined for you, beginning with the experience of generosity and ending with the experience of wisdom. So we can see here, just in this first glimpse of the Mahayana, that the Bodhisattva ideal opens up the practice of Buddhahood to lay people as well as to monks and nuns, and involves a far more expansive vision of the cosmos than anything that we've seen before. In that expanded vision also are celestial Buddhas and Bodhisattvas that will be the topic of our next lecture.